VOA 1 The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Gregory Stockel, Alice Bryant, Dan Novak, and Katie Weaver. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
New research suggests that the actual number of COVID-19 deaths in India could be as much as 10 times the official count. An independent non-government report released Tuesday estimates the number of deaths at between 3 to 4.7 million from January 2020 to June 2021. India's official government estimate of COVID-19 deaths is more than 414,000. But most health experts agree that the actual number is likely much higher. The new report estimates the number of excess deaths from the disease. This is generally defined as the difference between the number of observed deaths and the number of expected deaths during a specific period of time. The research was led by Arvind Subramanian, the Indian government's former chief economic advisor. Researchers from the Center for Global Development, a Washington-based think tank, and Harvard University also helped produce the report. The researchers admitted that it will be difficult to get a completely correct death number in India. However, such a number is likely to be an order of magnitude greater than the official count, they said. The team said the official count likely missed deaths because of overcrowded hospitals and widespread failures in the country's health system during a huge rise in cases earlier this year. True deaths are likely to be in the several millions, not hundreds of thousands, the report said. The researchers said this makes the deaths arguably India's worst human tragedy since partition and independence. Partition was a process that divided the British-ruled Indian subcontinent into independent India and Pakistan in 1947. When independence came, up to 1 million people are believed to have been killed in ethnic violence involving Hindus and Muslims. The report on India's COVID-19 deaths was based on three forms of data. One involved records from the civil registration system on births and deaths across 7 Indian states. Another used blood tests showing levels of the virus in India alongside worldwide COVID-19 death rates. In addition, information was used from an economic survey of nearly 900,000 people completed 3 times per year. The researchers warned that each method had weaknesses, such as the economic survey leaving out the causes of death. So they decided to look at deaths from all causes and compared that data to death rates in past years, a method widely considered accurate. The team also said that virus presence and COVID-19 deaths in the seven states studied may not be consistent across all of India. This is because the virus could have spread more in cities than rural areas, and the fact that healthcare quality greatly differs around India. Other nations are also believed to have undercounted deaths in the pandemic. But the difference is thought to have been greater in India because it has the world's second highest population at 1.4 billion. In addition, not all deaths are recorded in the country, even without a pandemic. India's health ministry did not immediately answer a request by the Associated Press to comment on the report. Dr. Jacob John, who studies viruses at Christian Medical College at Vellore in southern India, examined the report for the AP. John, who was not part of the research, said the report confirms the damaging effects that COVID-19 had on the country's unprepared health system. The research supports the observations of other fearless investigative journalists that have highlighted the massive undercounting of deaths. John added, "I'm Brian Lynn."
Students from New Zealand have developed sustainable materials made from the leaves of a tree local to New Zealand, the cabbage tree, and a plant whose seeds are often eaten, flax. Sustainable materials are products that are made that limit their harm to the environment and the amount of resources they take. They support a long-term ecological balance. The sustainable material the New Zealand students developed could soon be used to make high-performance outdoor sporting equipment like skis, kayaks, and skateboards. Their plan is to replace the traditional materials that are used like fiberglass and carbon fiber. Skateboards need to be strong. Ben Scales and William Morell are two students at New Zealand's University of Canterbury. They believe they can make them even stronger by using fiber from plants. After experimenting in their at-home workshops, they created new natural composite material or material made up of different items. Scales is 21 and studies product design. He said their first attempt is looking good. Scales said their first experimental product is a skateboard. It is made up of 25% fiber from a plant called Harakiki and 75% recycled polylactic acid, which is plastic made from cornstarch. He said the material is good to make a skateboard because it can take the force and shocks skateboards receive better than what skateboards are now made from, wood or carbon fiber. The fiber is taken from the Harakiki plant, which is a native flax plant in New Zealand. The fiber is mixed with different resins, which is a product that comes from some trees that can be used to cover a surface or hold objects together. Leaves from the cabbage tree are also an important part in their material. The plan is to use these sustainable materials to make skis, snowboards, and kayaks. These outdoor sporting items are currently made from non-natural materials like fiberglass and carbon fiber. The university students have found interest from possible business partners in other countries. Scales said some of the companies include businesses in Europe that make boats to skis, and a few overseas startups that are looking to shape the personal transport industry. He said they are looking to use sustainable materials that just are not offered in industries like that. So, they are wanting to use our material once we have gotten it ready, which will hopefully be soon. I'm Gregory Stockel.
When the COVID-19 pandemic closed their son's school, Bolivian parents Angela Poma and Lorenzo Gutierrez made some big changes. They wanted to give their boys, Willie, who was 9, and Carlos, who was 11, the ability to take online classes. The move to online schooling required the family to buy mobile phones, for example. They also moved from a rural area to the city of Viasha, where they could find better internet service. Viasha is just 22 kilometers southwest of the capital city of La Paz. The two parents make a living as street vendors, meaning they sell goods and products on the street. They do not earn much money and are spending up to $2 each day for internet service. Poma and Gutierrez also did not know how to use their new devices. "I couldn't even turn it on," said Poma about the mobile phone. In the past, she had had a phone only for calls, and that's it. The family was not alone in their need to learn how technology is used in their children's classes. So a group called the Internet Foundation Bolivia has been putting together classes for parents on how to operate their mobile phones. The foundation is also showing parents how to pay less for internet so they can save money as their children study online. Not all moms, dads, or teachers know of the digital tools that exist for online learning, said Esther Mamani. She is a volunteer with the foundation. Only around 4 in 10 people in the Andes Mountain country have internet. The number falls to just 3% in the more rural areas. That information comes from Bolivia's national telecommunications company. After she completed her studies, Poma went to the front of the class to receive her certificate. Her classmates put their hands together loudly for her. And later, everyone smiled and held up their certificates for a group picture. Now, Angela Poma and Lorenzo Gutierrez deal with the same issues of sharing and technology time limits as other parents. The younger one uses the mobile phone all morning, and the older one uses it from 3:30, said Poma. Sometimes I see my children fighting over the mobile phone when the battery starts running low, she said. I'm Alice Bryant.
The black and white photographs had stayed hidden for years. The images showed Native American students who were part of the first group to attend a boarding school in New Mexico. A boarding school is a school where students live during the school term. The first picture showed girls covered in cloth with Native American shoes on their feet. The next picture, taken just weeks later, was very different. In it, the students were in school uniforms. They wore work boots and large straw hats on their heads. The photographs were taken in 1885. History professor Larry Larricchio said he found the pictures while researching something else. He works at the Latin American and Iberian Institute at the University of New Mexico. Larricchio immediately recognized their importance. The images represented the attempt by the U.S. government, religious organizations, and other groups to assimilate Native youth into white society. The children were removed from their families and homes and sent to boarding schools. The effort lasted more than a century. Today, the U.S. government is seeking to learn more about the nation's policies on Native American boarding schools, where reports of physical and sexual abuse were widespread. The U.S. Interior Department has started going through records in hopes of finding past boarding schools and the names and tribes of students. The project also will try to find how many children died while attending those schools and were buried in mass graves. Last week, the dug-up remains of 9 Native American children who died more than 100 years ago were given to relatives. The children attended a government-run school in Pennsylvania. The remains were given to the Rosebud Sioux tribe in South Dakota.
Interior Secretary Deb Haaland is a member of the Laguna Pueblo tribe. She is the first Native American to lead a cabinet agency. She promised a full investigation, but she said it would be a painful and hard process. The Interior Department and the National Archives have some records related to the boarding schools. But most of the records are spread around in places across the country. Many others have been lost or destroyed over the years. The National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition has been working to collect information about the schools for almost 10 years. The Minnesota-based group has identified nearly 370 schools. The group estimates that hundreds of thousands of Native American children attended the schools between 1869 and the 1960s. Christine Dindizi McCleave is head of the group and a member of the Turtle Mountain Ojibwe Nation. She said the group has found records for only 40% of the schools they have identified. What the research and family stories show is that many children never came back home. The Interior Department has taken a first step to find more about the history. But Dindizi McCleave and others are pushing for the establishment of a federal committee. A similar committee was created in Canada, where the remains of more than 1,000 children have been found in recent weeks at schools there. In 1819, the United States passed the Indian Civilization Act. That and other laws supported Indian boarding schools across the nation. For over 150 years, Native children were taken from their communities and forced into boarding schools. New Mexico Indian Affairs Secretary Lynn Trujillo said her grandmother was taken to one of the boarding schools when she was 6 years old. Native communities have known about these atrocities for a very long time. But being able to bring them to light and talk about them, no matter how painful, is part of that process toward healing, Trujillo said.
For Dindizi McCleave, moving forward with healing will require more research, data, and understanding. She said part of knowing the full truth will be hearing the testimony of survivors and descendants. Experts say the list of known boarding schools and burial places will only grow with more research. In New Mexico, the Ramona Industrial School for Indian Girls opened in the mid-1880s. It was made up of mostly Apache students. Many of them had parents who were being held prisoner by the U.S. Army about 160 kilometers away. It was not far from the Santa Fe city center. Lauricchio was working on a project for the National Park Service years ago when he found reading material related to the school. Researching the school was a months-long effort that involved looking through hundreds of materials. There is only a small amount of information on the school. Some information is hidden in books that are about other subjects. A lot of this information is probably buried, literally buried, Lauricchio said. How many other stories are buried, and how much was purposefully destroyed? I'm Dan Novak.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Barack Obama. He first took office in 2009 and was re-elected in 2012. Because his presidency is so recent, this program will not try to offer a historical perspective. But one part of his legacy is already clear. Obama is the United States' first African-American president. His father was a black man from Kenya. His mother was a white American from the Midwestern state of Kansas. For many Americans, Obama's presidency was an important symbol in a country that permitted black people to be enslaved. And even after the U.S. Constitution officially banned slavery in 1865, African Americans have been extremely underrepresented in the U.S. government. By 2009, only 5 African Americans had ever served in the U.S. Senate, and Obama was one of them. Even many people who did not vote for Obama said his election to the country's highest office made them proud or hopeful. A public opinion survey immediately after Election Day found that 2/3 of Americans believed that the country's racial conflicts could be resolved. Obama's parents met as students at the University of Hawaii. His father had won a scholarship to study economics. His mother went on to earn a degree in math there, as well as a graduate degree. The two married and had a son, whom they named after his father, Barack Hussein Obama Jr. But the couple soon separated. The older Barack Obama returned to Kenya, where he later died in a car accident. Barack's mother went on to marry another man. He was from Indonesia. The family moved to Jakarta, and the couple had a daughter named Maya. When Barack was 10, his mother sent him back to Hawaii to live with her parents. She wanted him to get a good education. Barack finished high school in Hawaii, then went on to Occidental College in Los Angeles. After 2 years, he transferred to Columbia University in New York. There, he completed a degree in political science. But Obama said the best education he received was in one of his first jobs. He worked as a community organizer in Chicago. He helped people who lived in public housing put pressure on the city government to improve their conditions. Obama later said the work showed him how important it was to understand the legal process. So he entered Harvard Law School. Over the next years, Obama worked as a lawyer, wrote a book about his experience as a person of mixed race, and married Michelle Robinson, a woman he worked with at a law firm. She and Barack Obama settled in Chicago and had 2 daughters, Malia and Sasha. When he was in his mid-30s, Obama began his political career. He was elected 3 times to the Illinois State Senate. After 10 years there, he won a seat in the U.S. Senate in a landslide victory. That same year, Obama attended the Democratic National Convention, the meeting where the party officially nominates a presidential candidate. Obama was not one of the candidates, but the Democrats asked him to make an important speech. In it, Obama famously talked about how his life story was an American story. He said he was confident the U.S. could overcome its divisions and achieve unity. "There is not a liberal America and a conservative America," he said. "There's not a black America and white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's a United States of America." Only 4 years later, Obama would be elected its 44th president. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.